People will talk. Welcome to another episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me here, of course, is Maria and a special guest, Dr. Paul Hulla, who is living in Japan at the moment, originally from England. And he's very kindly joined us for today's chat, talking about ESL, music, poetry, haikus, and everything in between as well. So first of all, did I butcher your surname, Paul, or was it okay?
Just you've got it about right. It's Hulla. Yeah, I mean, it's the bane of my life. I grew up in England with nobody ever able to pronounce my surname, which is an old Yorkshire name, meaning from the hills. Hull means hill, you know, from the hill. It means kind of country dweller, basically. But it's not a very common name. There's one famous Hulla in the past, John Hulla, who was a composer in the Victorian era. He did some work with Charles Dickens. So, you know, at school I got called, of course, the dreadful 1970s, the hula hoop craze. So it was Hulla, Paul Hulla. Came to Japan thinking I've left all that behind. And actually, but in Japan, my name becomes Hada. And Hada is one of the most common Japanese surnames. So I get this now. My problem is that when I'm phone up to book a hotel or something in Japan, people think I'm using a false name. They're always like, why are you using a Japanese surname? It's like, no, it's my name, you know. But you got it fine. Brilliant.
I'm aware of an Irish-American comedian who spent a couple of years in China learning Chinese so he could do eventually a gig in Chinese. Yeah. And he has a whole routine about choosing his Chinese name and getting it wrong. And I think he chose a name that meant an appendage, and eventually he got it right everything. In Japan, is it the same for foreigners, where once you become part of the culture? No, it's not the same, no?
Well, the problem in Japan is that Japanese names traditionally are given with a family name first. So, you know, Sakamoto Ryuichi, Ryuichi Sakamoto, the composer that we know. In Japan is Sakamoto Ryuichi. So you have this weird thing with foreigners where they don't know which one to do first. So I get called Hada Paul or Paul Hulla or Hada Paul William Hulla Paul. It's just like always getting called different. I mean, you know, 30 years now, official documents like your bank documents and things that I've got different orders of my names on all these documents. So it can be tricky. My wife's Chinese, and my latest thing is learning Chinese. And when you go to China, they take the first syllable of your first name. Mm-hmm. So my first name is Paul, and they double it. So you get called Pao Pao. Mm-hmm. That's your kind of friendly name, Pao Pao. And I thought, oh, that sounds pretty cool. You know, the first time I went over there with my wife, and I was walking around thinking, Pao Pao, it sounds like a kind of strong name. Probably means something like warrior or something like that, you know. I found out later it means bubbles. I'm walking on bubbles, basically. It's tricky business language.
You're a walking West Ham man.
Right. Yeah, forever blowing. Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned, I mean, it's clear from what you've been talking about, you know, like you know where your name comes from. You've been telling us now just about Pao Pao and things like that. And, you know, from reading about you, you love words and literature, I think it's fair to say. And that's carried over into your ESL teaching. So we both have an ESL background as well. And from what I've read of you, you're not afraid to maybe buck the trends and introduce literature into classes. And I guess I have two questions for this. First of all, did you meet a lot of resistance with this? And secondly, you know, you also, I've seen an interview say, you know, I've had this girl, she's read, I can't remember who it was, but we'll say Dickens and Shakespeare. And why am I going to teach her how to ask directions? We have to adapt our needs to the students. So you know, connected to the first question, were you able to justify yourself a lot by giving these examples, and how were you able to position yourself as an EFL teacher, ESL teacher, but also one who's so literature focused as well?
Well, when I studied literature at university, and my PhD was a kind of feminist study of Christina Rossetti. So when I came to Japan, I was actually hired as a literature teacher. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I was going to be coming over here and teaching literature. But within about 20 minutes of the first class I taught, it became quite obvious to me that I was going to have to kind of like readjust my goal. I have tried to maintain literature, and a lot of work I do here is kind of basically trying to keep literature in the curriculum. Now, the problem there is, of course, as you say, you do meet resistance. Language has many registers, and the language that you have to first of all think of student needs, and obviously a lot of students need to learn a second language, to learn English for business or for communicating, general communication. So I'm not suggesting for one minute that we replace all the other ways English, all the other texts that are taught, and bring in, you know, the complete works of Shakespeare. Of course not. But what I'm saying is that, you know, literature, or what I call literary language, is a particular kind of language. It's where language is used carefully and with an emotive aspect. So how something is said becomes as important as what is being said. And to deprive learners of the option of that kind of exposure to that kind of language, I think it is a bit of a shame. So all I'm saying is that, you know, there should be a range of options open to learners, of which literature could be one of them. And of course, you have to cut your cloth for your customer. I'm very lucky because the jobs I've taught at about five different universities in my 30 years here. Most of the time I've been employed in literature departments teaching literature.
Yeah.
But I've also had classes where I've been teaching, you know, academic writing or you know, basic reading skills, things like that. I have met resistance from other faculty members if I've not been teaching in a literature faculty. But in a literature faculty, of course, I think people are quite open to somebody who comes in like myself and says, okay, one of the problems with literature, there are two problems.
Yep.
There are lots of problems, but there are two big problems with literature. The first is its name. As soon as you say literature, people freak out and start thinking, oh, well, here he comes with Paradise Lost in his saddlebag, and he's going to try and bring that in to a class of first years wanting to learn how to order a cup of coffee, you know. That's one of the problems with literature. The second problem with literature is the way that it's taught. It's often taught as a kind of puzzle. It's taught as if it's, we have to decode it. It's a very special kind of writing. That humiliates the students. I think teachers are the obviously often their worst enemy. Literature, the name, plus the way that people have traditionally taught it have been problematic. So what I do is to try to find my mantra is less is more. I try to find concentrated extracts from a literary text, a poem or something. I mean, I use that John Cooper Clarke, you know, the his haiku. John Cooper Clarke has a haiku, which is he's revised it over the years, but one version of it is to express one's thoughts in 17 syllables is very difficult. Okay, so the reason that haiku succeeds is purely because of the way the language is used. The haiku discipline has to be 17 syllables. But when he gets to the word difficult, he runs out of syllables, so he can't give the whole word. So it's diffic. Mm-hmm. So that haiku succeeds because of its kind of, it shows somebody being constricted and confined by the form, the literary form. But once we start taking that haiku apart, it becomes apparent that there's more going on. It shows that it's a Westerner who is missing the point of haiku, because he says to express one's thoughts. The purpose of Japanese haiku is not to express one's thoughts. The purpose of haiku is to give a, to convey a mood in a singular image. The poet has to actually disappear from the poem. So you can, you know, so actually what John Cooper Clarke's haiku there does is it shows this kind of disconnect between Western and Japanese ideas of poetry. And how it does that is by smashing language up, by showing that language becomes broken when we don't understand its purpose. So I would do a 90-minute class on that haiku, and maybe, you know, a few other haiku, and maybe ask the students what they think about haikus and get them writing their own.
Yeah.
Because the students I'm dealing with are, you know, they're fairly high level as well.
You must be a popular teacher, because not only do you, I've read as well that you demystify English poetry for Japanese students who might have preconceived conceptions about it being boring or difficult. You link the Sex Pistols to maybe, I don't know, Chaucer or kind of older English poetry. As a side note, there's a flower in the Retiro Park here in Madrid that's called the Sex Pistols flower as well. I've shown it to Maria.
Really?
There it is, yeah. So
the flowers in the dustbin. We're the flowers in the dustbin. I mean, you know that song "God Save the Queen." You know, yeah. I use that song. There's a line in it. I mean, the idea of punk rock was that language should not be poetic. It should be direct. That it shouldn't have any clutter. It should get rid of anything flowery or decorative. It should be, you know, like the Clash's first album. A lot of those songs are very straightforward. It's unambiguous. And yet the point of poetry is to be ambiguous, to let the reader enter into the language and construct meaning, because that's what life's like as well. Often things in life happen that we don't understand, and we have to make meaning from the chaos. So poetry becomes a mirror of life in that way. But the Sex Pistols, you've got John Lydon writing those lyrics, and you've got, you know, we're the poison in the human machine, we're the flowers in the dustbin. Those are two really beautiful images. So even in that medium, punk rock, which said we get rid of poetry, we're getting rid of these kind of imagery, you've got these brilliant images. So yeah, I use songs like that. Yeah, definitely.
Is it hard to balance that? Because I've seen before as well that you like also to teach maybe emotional intelligence to your students, maybe soft skills as well. So how does that factor into your classes when you're spending 90 minutes in a Japanese haiku? How and when do you bring in the elements of being maybe a better person or having more empathy?
Well, it's humanism basically, because you know, what I say to the students is that, you know, what's the point? What's the point of studying? What are we doing here? If, you know, we use language is all we've got to connect with each other. Language, you know, if you look at humanism, we've invented language in order that we can actually connect with people. And we need language in order to achieve empathy, and in order to express ourselves, in order to find similarities between ourselves and other people. That's why we've invented language. That's what makes it language really special and really important. So, you know, we better try and make the most of it. And the more we can understand about language, the more language we can get and use, then the more we empower ourselves as human beings. So, you know, I say, you know, everything you study, you should try and export something useful. you know, William Morris, I use William Morris, that thing that he said, you know, don't have anything in your house that isn't beautiful and useful. I think poetry has got to be useful. It's not just decoration. You know, I'm not, you know, I wouldn't use any kind of text which I didn't think would in some way connect with the student's level of experience. And that's difficult. You know, obviously, you know, you don't, that's another thing that teachers slip up on, I think. You know, they think, oh, I really like this poem, so the students will like it. Well, hold on a minute. I'm a 57-year-old bloke from England. These students are 21-year-old students from Japan. You know, what I like isn't necessarily going to be what they like. So, you know, it's that thing Morrissey says, you know, it says nothing to me about my life. You've got to find poems or texts that say something to the students about their lives. So, yeah, I mean, I tend to use poems as, or songs, for their thematic, for their content, as well as their form, but not just for their content. I mean, that's another problem. That's another thing that, you know, people tend to use. People say, okay, what's a good example? You know, this Amanda Gorman, people say, oh, let's look at this poem that she read out at the inauguration of Joe Biden. Isn't it wonderful? Doesn't this tell us about the history of mankind? It's like, well, no, if you want to study the history of mankind, study the history of mankind. You don't want a poem to do that. I mean, I think that's a mistake. You know, people say, oh, I'm going to bring in this poem because it's going to tell us all about, you know, the way in which the Industrial Revolution was a scary prospect to the Romantics. Well, you're better off actually studying a textbook about history if you're going to try and teach that. A poem is special because of the way it uses language.
Yeah.
So you have to always keep your eye on that. And yes, of course, you can use the theme or the tone of the poem to suggest something else. But basically, you've got to remember, what's the point? The point is that language here has been used in a special way. So, you know, you've got to really, you know, make that your starting point.
That's very interesting. We wanted to ask you about your experience living abroad, because obviously both of us have lived abroad for a while. But before that, I'm just very curious, because this is a doubt I've always had. And of course, you know, English people pronounce it one way, Spanish people another way. Just out of interest, and I think the listeners might be interested in this, how do you pronounce correctly? Is it haiku or haiku? And the plural, is it haikus? Or is it something completely different? Because we tend to say haikus as a plural, and just because, you know, we make plural with an S, but it might not necessarily be like that. This is a burning doubt I've had for years.
Well, Japanese, actually, okay, so Japanese nouns don't really have a plural, so they can be singular or plural, you know, by context. So haiku can be singular or plural. The thing that you have to be careful when you, maybe we don't need to know this outside Japan, but actually a haiku is one sort of poem which has 17 syllables. What the more kind of a haiku necessarily has to have some kind of specific link to nature or the seasons. It has to be kind of nature poem. The most famous haiku is the in Japanese, it's furuikea kawaza tobikomi mizu no oto. It means an old pond, a frog jumps in, the sound of the water. And the seasonal word there is the frog, because the frogs are born in a particular time of year. So that's a haiku. But there are other, like, you know, Ezra Pound wrote the Inner Station of the Metro, the appearance, what is it? The appearance of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. That's not a haiku. Well, it is a haiku. We call it a haiku, but Japanese would call that a senryu, because that means a non-seasonal haiku. So that would be a senryu. So when I talk to students here, like John Cooper Clarke's haiku isn't a haiku for Japanese. They say, yeah, they're like, where's the season word? There isn't a si-, and I'm like, okay, yeah. So yeah, but the pronunciation's haiku.
Okay, very singular. Okay, now I feel better. I remember haiku. That and try to try not to say haikus in plural. Okay, fair.
Oh, you can say haikus. No, I wouldn't worry about okay. that. I wouldn't stay awake worrying about that.
That was just my own paranoia. But yeah, we were just wondering, because basically when you move to another country, even if it's within Europe, it's already, you know, quite a thing. And I don't know, probably you can be yourself up to a point, but then, you know, you're never quite, or we feel maybe you're not quite always the same person. So this is like just between countries that are really close, but, you know, moving, say, like from England or from Scotland to Japan, you know, do you feel like completely at ease there? Do you feel you can be yourself?
It's really funny, isn't it? You know, we construct our identity through language. So when you start to speak a second language, I mean, they use this as therapy, don't they? I heard that in prisons, in some American prisons, they teach prisoners a second language as a kind of therapy, because in order to, you know, when you start learning a second language, and language is culture, because when you learn a language, you learn a culture. The culture is inscribed in language as well, to a certain extent. When you're actually living somewhere, obviously you're getting that daily 24 hours anyway. When you start learning a second language, you actually have to rebuild yourself. And you do find, I mean, I don't know if you find this speaking English, but
yeah,
sometimes, you know, when I speak Japanese, I become someone else. And it's kind of annoying. It's kind of annoying sometimes. I think especially if I hear myself, if I'm speaking Japanese and somebody's taking a video and I see myself, I think, who's that guy? You know, that's not me. And I talk to my students all the time about this. You know, I say, you know, don't lose yourself. Keep yourself. You know, your goal speaking English is not to become a native speaker. Your goal is to become you speaking English and writing as well. I often say writing, you know, don't lose yourself. Don't try and write like someone else. Try and write like yourself. How's about that for an idea? You know, what about you? Do you, when you speak English, do you feel like you're different?
I think so. I mean, less with time, but it's true that, yeah, I think it's quite a funny thing, because sometimes, or at first, when I first did, I kind of almost felt more confident in English, but it's because you put that distance with yourself. So I was a bit the opposite to you. It was like when I listened to myself, because I didn't recognize myself, I felt like more comfortable. It's like, okay, I can just like have this, you know, all the persona, because all the things that I would normally, or the way I would normally express, I'm moving my hands a lot while I'm saying this, which is very Spanish, were hard to express through English. So I had to like just lose them. So that's why we were interested. I mean, I think foreigners is exactly the same, like the other way around. You know, he's used to speaking English, and then in Spanish, I'm sure it's the same for him. That, you know, we've talked about it plenty of times, that you end up sort of like adapting certain things, even if you're fluent, you still sort of like adapt yourself a little bit. I guess.
When I met Maria, she was fluent in English, but for the last few years, we've been working on her Hiberno English. And making her an Irish speaker.
And even though
you speak really well, you have a terribly, we have always this back and forth about accents. I don't think Maria.
Yeah.
Can,
yeah.
Like you're listening to Dante's Inferno on an audiobook, And you're trying to convince me it was like someone from Lancashire or something, or Northern England. I was like,
no, that's not it. I'm actually the expert of accents. He's the one that has problems.
I hope you can understand me, because I think my accent's probably all over the place. You kind of code switch, don't you, depending on who you're talking to?
Yeah, of course. It
is really interesting. You know, a lot of Japanese is a very formal language, as you would imagine. And it has lots of registered different levels of politeness. There are a lot of set phrases in Japanese which are actually redundant, basically meaning wise, but if you don't say them, it's considered rude or something like that. And a lot of Japanese students, and if you ask any non-Japanese kind of English speaking teacher in Japan, if you ask them this, I'm sure they tell you the same. We get a lot of students coming to us when they have problems at home or with relationships, or something's worrying them, and they will come to my office and sort of spill their heart out. And I've had a lot of students say, the reason I come to you is because I can't do this in Japanese. I can't be emotional like this. Obviously they do it because they trust me and they hope that I might give them some advice. But I mean, I say, why don't you ask your, I say, I'm not your tutor. This guy's your tutor, the Japanese guy down the corridor. Why don't you? And they say, oh, I couldn't do that. And I said, but he's a nice guy. He's a great guy. And they say, yeah, but in Japanese, I don't feel free. When I speak English, I feel free.
I think
that's interesting.
I think it's very important what you said as well about teaching your students not to become English or become American or whatever it would be, whatever.
Obviously, there's
many ways to speak English, but when it comes to EFL, there's a huge focus on British or American.
Do you get that? This thing, do they all say, oh, I want to speak American English?
I get that a lot, yeah. Or the big things like speaking like with a British accent, like in the Crown or something. I'm thinking,
there's no point.
And also, students like if he Roberto, he's Robert in the class. I was like, no, you're not Robert. You're Roberto. Keep your name.
Oh, that old gag. Yeah. I just almost like keeled over when I heard that. Yeah, there are some teachers who give their students Western names. It's like, oh, come on, Oh, I couldn't believe that when I first heard it. Yeah, I would never do that.
I think there's a few things we want to touch on. There's one big thing, I guess, it all kind of fits in really into one super question, I guess. We've listened to your music, and for example, you sent us the song Iris, which it's got like some great chill out vibes. There's like someone speaking over, which is probably yourself, I imagine. We know as well, like, that you've done work with Ian Rankin, Iris Murdoch. Yeah. You're an essayist. You've written poetry. The question is, how do you adapt to all these different things that you've done, and also collaborating with all these other people who all have their own career directory as well? They're kind of big names, and must be a bit of a head spinner sometimes.
Well, it's that kind of, and it's funny because the first thing you started on about language, you said loving words and language. And the thing that unites everything I do is language. I suppose, dilettante, dabbler, jack of all trades, master and all. The problem is that people don't like that. It's weird how culture's gone like that as well. I was reading something the other day about, When I was a lad in the 70s, if a band released an album that was exactly the same as the one before it, they were ridiculed for it. The idea was that you developed, it's like we used to make jokes about Status Quo and Motorhead. It was like, you just don't need to buy the new album, just buy the last one and play it twice, And all the bands that you liked, you looked forward to their next album because it was going to be something different. It was not going to be the same. Whereas now, it's like, Adele, you've got Adele makes the same album three times, Ed Sheeran, it's like people, and movies,
yeah.
the kind of remakes and the sequels, and it's like people want something safe. They want one thing. You're only allowed to be one thing. And I feel like my life, you know, I've just tried to be happy. I've just tried to do things which, you know, what's the purpose of life? The purpose of life is to try and do good things and improve yourself. And, you know, by doing that, try and improve things for people around you. I'm not good at much stuff. I mean, the only thing I'm really good at, or not bad at, is putting words together in certain ways. I seem to be able to do that. I always saw myself as, I mean, the thing that gives me the most pleasure language-wise is writing poetry. But, yeah, there's not really much market for that. And, why do I do that? Well, I do that because it gives me a sense of calm, and also it helps me make sense of what's going on in my life and around me. But, you know, what else am I going to? Well, I'd like to explain and express that to other people. So teaching gives me pleasure. And Iris Murdoch, Christina Rossetti, the writers that I've gotten written about, I like connecting myself with them because they do it better than I do, in my opinion. So therefore, you know, I want to get into that garden and see how they've arranged it, you know, and see if I can, you know, improve myself by dint of, you know, vicariously experiencing what they do. I was lucky enough to meet Iris Murdoch and actually edited a book of her poetry. So that was really an incredibly, I felt incredibly blessed to be able to do that. And it's not really, I mean, to me, there's not much difference. I mean, you know, I met Iris Murdoch. She's a wonderful person. She's a great human being. She was funny. She influenced me a lot. The things that she wrote, I think, are brilliant, and they really have changed my way of living. The romantic poets that I regard as the kind of, you know, the first generation of punk rockers, in a way, I see very little difference between the way I conceive of them and the way I conceive of somebody like David Bowie, or, you know, the artists that I liked when I was young. So I don't see it as a problem. I suppose I must do subconsciously because I'm trying to justify it very inanely, but I don't know.
It's approaching, I believe, 10 p.m. in Japan. No, it's 9:40 on your side of the world. There's so much, you know.
Have I gone on for too long?
No, it's been fascinating. You know, you're living in Japan. It's a country that has captured the attention of so many people. And as you've discussed, so many insights as well into different strands of culture throughout time. And it's definitely been a pleasure for me. I don't want to speak for Maria, but I'm assuming it's been for her as well.
Of course, you're brilliant. Thank you so much for speaking to us. And hopefully we'll have you again sometime, because there was so much more that we wanted to ask. But we're going to run out of time.
Once the world starts to behave itself again, Madrid is now top of our list of destinations.
Oh, perfect. Well, there we'll have you.
So we'll be darkening your doorstep one of these days. So watch out. We'll have you live.